Hello and welcome to Bone Up, the podcast all about bones, how we make them, why we break them, and if we fully understand them. I'm David Armstrong.
Hi, and I'm Richie Abel. And over this series, we're going to be exploring osteoporosis, bones, what we know and what we're yet to discover. And we hope you will join us on the journey.
So for anyone keen to learn more about our infrastructure of calcified collagen, this is Bone Up. Welcome back to episode 3 of Bone Up Live at the ECTS here in Innsbruck, Austria. We have some more interesting interviews lined up for you, which I hope you will enjoy.
Listeners, we're really pleased to introduce our next guest, Dr. Morten Svare Hansen. He has two appointments at two university hospitals in Denmark. The first in the Department of Endocrinology at the University Hospital of Southern Denmark, and his second is a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Endocrinology at Unser University. We English people pronounce it Odense.
Well, just when we're looking at the football scores, but we've learned that it's Unser.
And congratulations, Morten. You won the prize for the best clinical paper at ECTS 2025. That's a really big award. How are you feeling?
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for letting me participate in this podcast. So, obviously, I feel very good, but I mean, I also would like to use the opportunity to just announce that while, you know, I was the face of the paper, that this is obviously something that a lot of other people contributed to in a manner that allowed me to be up there and present the data. So it's also for my co-authors that I just want to state, but on behalf of them, and also, of course, on behalf of myself, I'm extremely proud because this is such a big acknowledgement that you put a lot of time and effort into, from planning a clinical trial, receive the funding, recruit the participants, fulfill the trial, and then write up the data. And then, I mean, it all ends out in a paper that's, you know, not really that many pages, but get the acknowledgement to that it was of a certain quality and present the data is really nice.
You were talking about a drug or a family of drugs that's very topical at the moment, not always associated with bone health. So tell us a little bit about what you were talking about.
Yeah, so we talked about semaglutide, which is a GLP-1 receptor agonist. So it means that it mimics the effects of a natural occurring gut hormone known as GLP-1. So I actually used a slide just to show the timeline for approval of GLP-1 receptor agonist, because the first one was approved in 2005 for type 2 diabetes, but later GLP-1 receptor agonists have also been approved for type 2 diabetes and obesity. But I used that table as a timeline because that things have really escalated within the last 5-6 years within this area, because, you know, it's been called a blockbuster drug because that people who are not even obese or severely overweight can lose weight. So, I mean, it's become a very popular drug, and it has been so popular that the demand has overseed the manufacturer's availability of the drug as well. So,
wow.
Yeah. So it really is a popular drug, and it's also a very good drug that has many beneficial effects.
Yeah, so it's like a weight loss drug, but tell us how it affects the bones then.
Yeah. So I just want to state first that the dosage that we used was the dosage that we normally use in patients with type 2 diabetes. So that's 1 milligram, right? Yeah. So the idea of this clinical trial was based on a series of mainly animal trials. So it seemed like GLP-1 receptor agonist could increase bone mass in bone loss models, or maybe even protect against bone loss from these bone loss models. And there were some studies in cells that indicated increases in osteoblast and decrease in osteoclast activity and so on. So we hypothesized that treatment with this type of drug would have effects on bone, beneficial effects on bone formation. Mm-hmm. And we find that interesting because, I mean, when we talk about osteoporosis, the thing is that we do not have that many drugs to choose between, and some of them, I mean, they're in the same group of drugs. So, so with this, I mean, if we had something that was already available in the toolbox that, that had bone formative effects, I mean, suddenly it, the idea was that, well, could it be repurposed for treatment of low bone mass?
It could be another pathway,
exactly.
Yeah. So what happened then?
So what happened is that we looked, I mean, we used DEXA scans and blood samples to look at bone turnover markers, and we had bone biopsies to really assess bone remodeling at a tissue level. So, but we actually didn't see any difference in bone formation in circulating markers or in our bone biopsies after 52 weeks of treatment. And we compared semaglutide to placebo, which in this case was saline. Mm-hmm. So, but on the other hand, we saw a massive increase in CTX, which is a bone resorption marker. And we also observed significant decreases in bone mineral density at the lumbar spine and in the total hip after 1 year of treatment.
Wow. So you're basically in humans and you're finding kind of opposite results to what was previously reported in mice.
Exactly. Actually, the complete opposite.
Wow. Mm. We often talk about mouse and human research and how relevant is human mouse research to human research. What else did you find when you investigated?
So we also had some extreme CT scans, which is mainly made of the distal radius and the distal tibial part of the skeleton, and that's to distinguish trabecular from cortical bone compartments. And we observed that cortical thickness and the volumetric bone mineral density in the tibia, but not in the radius, was decreased with semaglutide. So that led us to the assumption that, or the part conclusion that the effects were mainly observed on the weight-bearing parts of the skeleton. And this corresponded very nicely to the fact that we also observed that the average weight loss was 9% within 52 weeks when in the semaglutide group compared to placebo group.
Okay.
So just to finish that, I mean, we think that it induces, you know, this unloading effect on the skeleton that we know from the mechanostat theory will eventually increase resorption and remove bone, because that the threshold, the strain threshold, has changed when you lose weight.
So I suppose the next question then is, for this group of patients who took the semaglutide, how was their bone mineral density and their bone health at baseline? And how did it change? Did it move towards osteoporosis or osteopenia?
So so they were in one of the inclusion criteria were that they had to have, I mean, what we called increased fracture risk, which was either a T score at the lumbar spine or total hip or femoral neck below -1, or low energy fracture, so an osteoporotic fracture within 3 years of recruitment. Mm-hmm. So but we did have 15 participants who had osteoporosis either based on their DEXA scan or based on a low energy fracture. But some of the participants attended the study because that they didn't wanted the conventional anti-osteoporosis treatment, right? So we did assess at the end of the study all of our participants and advised them, depending on their DEXA scan and T-score, if they were candidates for osteoporosis treatment. I can't remember the exact number, but I'm pretty sure that it was not more than one who might have went from the osteopenic T-score into the osteoporotic T-score. But, I mean, it's something that we definitely should be aware of.
So what do we do next then? Do we co-prescribe bisphosphonate with the semaglutide? Do you tell patients if they're going to take the semaglutide they have to do weight-bearing exercise? Where are you going next with your study?
Well, I think first of all, I mean, exercise and focus on nutrient intake when you start these type of drugs is a recommendation that you mm-hmm. should provide your patients. For the other question, I mean, it's very important to look into risk factors, right? Do they have risk factors? So it's an individual assessment but it's definitely something that we as medical doctors need to think about. So obviously there's a difference if you put a 35-year-old male who is obese on this drug, yeah, or if you put maybe a fragile old person who has a history of a low energy fracture into this drug. So it's an individual assessment, but knowing that this type of drug induces an almost 10% weight loss, you, as a medical doctor, you need to expect that they will lose some sort of bone. And then it's up to you to kind of assess, well, is this something that makes it a higher risk for you to, let's say, develop osteoporosis?
And Are you certain that's not something to do with the pathway, the GLP-1 pathway? It's definitely due, well, I'm not asking a scientist to say anything's definite, but your hunch at the moment is it's the fact you're just unloading the bone, there's not as much weight bearing, and therefore the bone is responding to that. You don't think there's a bit of the pathway that you don't understand that it's maybe contributing to bone loss as well?
I think it's worth looking into, actually, because the thing with this trial, and that's something that you can look at afterwards, that when we do see this massive weight loss, it really makes it difficult to distinguish potential direct from indirect effects, right? So one of the things that we talked about was that it would have been fantastic to have a third arm in our trial in which, you know, participants lost the same amount of weight but on calorie restrictions only, because then we would have a chance to do a head-to-head comparison between what is the bone loss after calorie restriction on diet alone, and what is the bone loss when you use semaglutide.
Or a fourth arm using weight-bearing exercise alone to lose weight.
Yeah.
Positive and negative control.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that the some people are taking the drug even if they're not very obese, maybe just overweight, maybe not obese. What would this mean for those people? Are there any plans to do any research on them and how the weight loss might affect their bone health?
So, I mean, one of the things that, of course, makes it difficult now is that now we have data that shows a potential negative effect of a drug, right?
It's harder to do more research.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, when we design a study, both thinking about how to fulfill the experiment, but also very much because of the ethical consideration of what it's like to include participants that we know might lose bone, right? So what we are thinking about doing next is to actually look into patients who are per se candidates to receive this treatment so that we include someone who otherwise would actually still be candidates to be prescribed this. So that has changed our mind of who to include from when we designed this trial.
And I don't know if this is an unfair question. Did you ask the subjects, the patients, what they thought of the balance between losing weight? Because I presume most of them were very happy to have lost a lot of weight. But if you said to them, look, you've lost a little strength in your bone as well, what did the patients think of that as a potential side effect?
It's actually a very good question. And actually, once again, I think I need to go back to the time and the fact that you know, knowledge has really escalated within this field, because I can still remember talking to some of our participants that at that time we didn't quite have the data on what happens when you stop the treatment. And then along came, well, these studies that you regain weight when you stop. So I told them, please don't change all your clothes if you start losing weight. But obviously we actually invited all our participants to discuss the data because it showed the opposite of what we found. And I mean, it was a fantastic group of people and they had very nice questions. I didn't ask that particular questions, but I mean, most of them were postmenopausal women, so they had some sort of idea of what it's like to have osteoporosis and have focus on bone health. So it's actually something that I think we need to maybe address a bit more when we design our studies to interview participants or at least relatives. Yeah.
Wonderful. This is a really interesting story. I hope that you continue to research it, and hopefully we'll see you at future ECTSs so we can get a bit of an update on how you're getting on. I think a lot of the listeners are going to be excited to hear more.
Yeah, it's a story I think that has repercussions outside just the bone world as well, doesn't it? It's an interesting general concept.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Morten.
Listeners, I'm very, very pleased to announce our next guest. It's Mr. Jamie Rowe, who is PhD in the Bone Health Research Group at Imperial, which is our group, and his primary supervisor is Ulrich Hansen, who's my closest collaborator for 10 years, and I think this is a really exciting research project. Welcome, Jamie.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Thanks for coming to the podcast. Jamie is a relatively early career researcher then, as opposed to some other people who've been at this for a long time. But I mean, one of our aims, I think, in the podcast is to give a voice to people who are starting off and to encourage them that we're all part of the bone community and we can all learn from each other. So we will ask you some
hard questions now about your research. You look terrified.
It's fibre training. How have you found your first ECTS?
Yeah, it's been great. Really interesting talks. Good to talk to lots of different people.
And you presented your poster here. Did people come and talk to you about it?
Yeah, had a few people come over and ask me questions and things.
Nice.
Always good to get different opinions.
You've been doing some work then on, let me call it, the quality of bone or the strength of bone. Tell us a little about just what you've been looking at and why you've been looking at it.
So at the nanoscale, bone is a composite material. Basically, you have a sort of deformable collagen molecules and brittle mineral. And in man-made composite materials, we often kind of attribute their good mechanical properties to kind of the formation of basically residual stresses. These are sort of stresses that form during manufacturing generally.
Okay, and we'll translate that and saying by composite materials, you make things like concrete?
Yeah, so something like pre-stressed concrete, basically where you have...
Pre-stressed concrete, okay.
Concrete and then steel bars generally.
Okay.
And basically in pre-stressed concrete, you have the steel bars are kind of put under tension, the concrete is poured over, mm-hmm. and then the tension is like released, and basically then those steel bars kind of compress up and put the concrete under compression, basically. And that drastically increases the ability of concrete to kind of withstand tensile forces.
So it's almost like a coil spring inside the concrete, which is compressing it and making it even stronger than it would be by itself. So it turns out human bone might be like that, is it?
Yeah, exactly. So we believe that basically collagen kind of has this. So this is work that kind of came from Peter Fratzel in Potsdam. We believe that collagen kind of has a similar role to those steel bars in the concrete, where during the process of bone formation, the collagen kind of starts to shrink up, mm-hmm. and then that puts the mineral sort of under compression, and then that will give bone its great mechanical properties, basically. Mm. So I've been trying to understand the molecular origin of this.
And water is important in that process, is it? How wet the bone is, how much water there is in it?
Yeah, so we can just think about tendons, which were, is kind of, you can just think of unmineralized collagen. And we understand that when tendons sort of dry up or are put under osmotic pressure, so kind of water is removed from the collagen, mm-hmm. the collagen molecules start to shrink up.
Yeah.
And so the kind of idea is what if a similar process is happening when the mineral starts forming, right? So the mineral kind of comes in, replaces the water.
Yeah.
And then that replacement of the water removes, causes the collagen to kind of shrink up. But the thing is, we don't currently understand why collagen shrinks up when it is put under, it dries up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've been trying to look at, basically. Why does collagen like to kind of shrink up when water is removed?
So when the collagen shrinks and starts to pre-stress the mineral, how much would that increase the strength of bone by?
So we can estimate from experiments that it is of the order of tens of megapascals, which is sort of equivalent to kind of the peak stresses that you undergo during daily motion. So we can imagine this kind of almost doubles this strength of bone, basically. Wow. You know, you can imagine that during motion, you're actually kind of just undoing that pre-stressing rather than adding extra stress to the bone.
Yeah, so that makes a huge difference then. If you're doubling the sort of strength of bone, that but by sort of tensing it, that makes a big difference.
Could there be a role for this kind of pre-stressing in rare bone diseases? We've heard quite a lot of the conference about osteogenesis imperfecta, where mutations in the collagen cause it to malform and lead to malformation of the mineral.
Yeah, so one of the things we found in my research was that these pre-stress behavior seems to be localized to very specific amino acids, basically, in collagen. So we found that the collagen has this kind of repeating pattern, but the amino acid pattern kind of changes as you go along. Mm-hmm. And we found that most of the collagen amino acids don't actually change when they're kind of dehydrated. In fact, actually, most of them kind of expand slightly. And the contraction is actually kind of localized to a handful of very important, clearly, amino acids. So then we can start to think about rare bone disease and think about mutations. So if you, for example, mutate some of these regions, do you then kind of reduce the ability for the collagen to pre-stress the mineral?
So we know as you get older, your bones become dehydrated in general in humans. Bones dry up. Mm-hmm. So that could be in itself contributing to the weakness of the bones, just the fact that bones tend to dehydrate as you get older. Potentially, could we rehydrate older people's bones in some way? That's a hard question.
It's an interesting one, though, isn't it? Be a very cheap treatment, potentially. Mm. You know? Yeah.
Look, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks for coming and sharing your work. We look forward to speaking to you in another 10 years, you know, when you're running your own lab and just as successful as Richie is.
Thanks for having me.
Jamie's brighter than me. He's going to go further.
Well, that's great. I hope you've enjoyed your first conference and enjoyed your first visit to Bone Up.
Yeah, it's been great.
Awesome. Thank you.
Listeners, we have our next guest with us, Friederike Schulte from the Institute of Biomechanics at ETH Zurich. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome here. I'm glad to be here.
And thank you for coming back to join us. We spoke to you last year.
Yeah, we had a really fantastic episode of the podcast where we were speaking to you about your animal trials where you had potentiated the effect of romosozumab using mechanical loading in a mouse model. This year you've come back with the next stage of the research and you gave a really fantastic talk yesterday morning about MPA models. Would you tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing?
Yes, sure. Micro-MPA models are another approach to learn more about the mechanisms behind and more at the cellular and the molecular level, because what we did before is using microcomputed tomography scans of a preclinical mouse model of osteoporosis. And there we can see how the morphometry and the bone remodeling changes over time. But we don't have access there to the molecules and which molecule is expressed and how are the bone cells communicating with each other. And that's still the key question, why would we see changes in the microstructure of the bone according to osteoporosis, according to mechanical loading, or also to pharmacological treatment. So we really wanted to understand what are the molecular mechanisms, and using micro multiphysics agent-based modeling, so micro MPA modeling, is an approach that goes bottom up, actually. That is to say, we use mathematical rules that we define ahead, and those rules are really on the molecular level. How do pre-osteoclasts multinucleate into osteoclasts, and which proteins do the osteocytes release, and which signals do those molecules mm-hmm. then trigger regarding osteoblasts or osteoclasts? So these rules are all defined in the beginning. And then you give an input, a real experimental in vivo structure of the abascal scan, actually, of such a bone. And then the model is run over iterations and iterations, and you hope that the output, the bone microstructure that you get in silico as an output, that this would fit to the experimental microstructure that you saw in the experiment.
Well, what did you find when you compared your MPA model to the real mouse data?
We try to calibrate regarding the bone volume fraction. This is our primary goal. And this worked out in the in the mice. And we defined, or we hope that with such micro MPA models, we can then test and validate or also reject hypotheses that we set at the cellular molecular level. For example, in the study I presented yesterday, we tried to simulate postmenopausal osteoporosis in an animal model of osteoporosis by ovarectomy, which results then in a bone loss in the next 5 to 9 weeks. And we tried to define those rules by saying that on the pre-osteoclasts, we reduced the number of bound-to-unbound receptors, and rank L receptors, I had to say. Mm-hmm. And this facilitates the multinucleation into the active osteoclast.
Yeah.
So osteoclasts, yeah, are more proactive, and this also led to a reduction in bone mass, as we had expected.
So what you're saying is, instead of doing the experiment sort of on a real mouse, to put it like that, you're creating a model. And when you say a model, it's a computer model. Isn't that right?
Exactly, yes.
So, and then you're sort of doing the experiment on the computer model. and you can move all the turn the knobs up and down and increase this and reduce that, and then you're checking to make sure that your computer model actually reflects the sort of work has already been done in mice to make sure that it's accurate. And then you can do lots of new work on the computer model, which has never been done on the mouse. That's the sort of thinking.
That's exactly the way of thinking. And because in the computer model, we will then, once we have validated the computer model, we have access to molecular concentrations, also the cytokine dynamics over time, which is very hard to get in vivo.
In a mouse.
Even in the mouse. But once it's validated, we can then see how, for example, sclerostin expression changes over time, or Rankl expression goes up, or what. And this is quite interesting. And from this, micro-MPA models are used very much in order to also generate new hypotheses, because you have the chance to test various pathways, two or three.
You can do all sorts of crazy things in your model that you wouldn't maybe want to do on the mouse. You can, yeah.
As well.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, can, yes. yeah, can generate and all sorts of hypotheses.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of a contribution towards the 3R principles to reuse existing experimental in vivo data that we have in order to validate micro-MPA models, which then hopefully in the future can then also give new insights into clinical outcomes and data.
And you have to use fewer mice then, obviously, as part of your experiments, which is a good thing.
Because we can pre-test certain hypotheses, and when we find in silico that this is worth investigating, then only then can you go in vivo experiments.
So you can greatly reduce the number of animals in the research and ask questions in the model that you might not be able to answer with the animals at all.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm. It's an amazing contribution.
A cynic might listen to this and say, well, that's great. You're creating a perfect model of what the bone regeneration is like in mice. Why not do that in humans? Why bother with the intermediate step as you've got a computer that you can just create your own model then?
Exactly. It's a very good question. So the input structure that we give is an animal structure, but of course the input structure can also be a clinical biopsy or PQCT scan, of course, a patient scan. And the reason why we do the preclinical modeling is that as an in silico person, you always have to face the question, how much can I trust your model, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is an attempt to first really validate and show that it works on the preclinical data, because with the in vivo microcomputer tomography data, we do have the endpoints and the experimental structure at the endpoint, where we can then show whether our model is able to reproduce this exact in vivo experimental structure, which we sometimes don't have in the clinics. And therefore, we want to gain more confidence on our model by validating it experimentally.
And it's easier to validate it with mice.
Exactly.
And then once you can show that your model is really working well, then you can, with more confidence, probably put the human data into it and say, well, we confidence this will work well as a human model as well. Yeah,
And also, the microcomputer tomography gives you a higher resolution, so you can see the individual trabeculae and also the modeling and the resorption sites much in a higher resolution. And this is closer to the rules that we apply at the cellular level. So if you're confident in that the model works on the high resolution images, then we can also apply it in the clinics.
It's amazing research, and you can see it's lovely to see how your research is growing and developing, and every year you have something new to share with us. It's wonderful.
Yeah, come back next year and you'll have something even more exciting to talk about.
Yes, of course. I mean, there's a lot to do, so because all the medications are there, and also when we see here in the sessions, the different branches, or which medication to take after which one. So there's a lot of potential and a lot of questions. That's also what I took from yesterday. The more you talk with people about the bone research, the more questions arise, and there's really a lot more to investigate.
I remember making a comment last year that you were sending your mice to the gym, so now you'll be sending your computer model to the gym. That's the thinking.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I thought of that picture actually, and it's a couple of times, and it's true. Yeah, mechanical loading is kind of sending them to the gym. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a funny picture.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Lovely to speak to you again.
Thank you for having
bye
me
bye.
Here. Bye bye.
And we hope you can join us for the fourth and final episode recorded here in Innsbruck, which will be released very soon. Bye now.